Looks like Alberto Gonzalez is walking out right now. Let's listen in.
Good morning. 13 years ago, I entered public service to make a positive difference in the lives of others. And during this time, I have traveled a remarkable journey from my home state of Texas to Washington, D.C., supported by the unwavering love and encouragement of my wife, Rebecca, and our sons, Jared, Graham, and Gabriel. Yesterday, I met with President Bush and informed him of my decision to conclude my government service as Attorney General of the United States, effective as of September 17, 2007. Let me say that it has been one of my greatest privileges to lead the Department of Justice. I have great admiration and respect for the men and women who work here. I have made a point as Attorney General to personally meet as many of them as possible. And today I want to again thank them for their service to our nation. It is through their continued work that our country and our communities remain safe, that the rights and civil liberties of our citizens are protected, and the hopes and dreams of all of our children are secured. I often remind our fellow citizens that we live in the greatest country in the world, and that I have lived the American dream. Even my worst days as Attorney General have been better than my father's best days. Public service is honorable and noble, and I am profoundly grateful to President Bush for his friendship and for the many opportunities he has given me to serve the American people. Thank you, and God bless America.
Why are you leaving?
For President Bush, who's in Waco, Texas, expected to address the news that his attorney general is resigning.
This morning, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez announced that he will leave the Department of Justice after 2.5 years of service to the department. Al Gonzalez is a man of integrity, decency, and principle. And I have reluctantly accepted his resignation with great appreciation for the service that he has provided for our country. As Attorney General and before that as White House counsel, Al Gonzalez has played a critical role in shaping our policies in the war on terror and has worked tirelessly to make this country safer. The Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act, and other important laws bear his imprint. Under his leadership, the Justice Department has made a priority of protecting children from internet predators. He's made enforcement of civil rights laws a top priority. He aggressively and successfully pursued public corruption and effectively combated gang violence. As Attorney General, he played an important role in helping to confirm two fine jurists in Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Samuel Alito. He did an outstanding job as White House counsel, identifying and recommending the best nominees to fill critically important federal court vacancies. Alberto Gonzalez's tenure as Attorney General and White House counsel is only part of a long history of distinguished public service that began as a young man when, after high school, he enlisted in the United States Air Force. When I became governor of Texas in 1995, I recruited him from one of Texas's most prestigious law firms to be my general counsel. He went on to become Texas's 100th Secretary of State and to serve on our state's Supreme Court. In the long course of our work together, this trusted advisor became a close friend. These various positions have required sacrifice from Al, his wife Becky, their sons Jared, Graham, and Gabriel. And I thank them for their service to the country. After months of unfair treatment that has created a harmful distraction at the Justice Department, Judge Gonzalez decided to resign his position, and I accept his decision. It's sad that we live in a time when a talented and honorable person like Alberto Gonzalez is impeding from doing important work because his good name was dragged through the mud for political reasons. I've asked Solicitor General Paul Clement to serve as acting Attorney General upon Alberto Gonzalez's departure and until a nominee has been confirmed by the Senate. He's agreed to do so. Paul is one of the finest lawyers in America. As Solicitor General, Paul has developed a reputation for excellence and fairness and earned the respect and confidence of the entire Justice Department. Thank you.
Put myself. going to have to fight you in court?
No, no. I'm not going to go to court unless you want me there.
Because I don't want to be in court either.
Okay, I don't either. But, here's the way it works. You'll be released today, okay?
Okay.
All right. I know I can bring you to jail, but that's not my goal here, okay?
Let's do that.
I'm not going to bring you to jail.
You solicited me.
Okay.
We can get into that. Okay.
But there's two ways. Yes, you can go to court. You can plead guilty.
Yeah.
There'll be a fine. You won't have to explain anything. And no,
all right.
No, and you pay a fine. You leave. That's it. Done. Or if you want to plead not guilty, and I can't make these decisions for you.
No, just tell me where I am. Because
if you go not guilty,
guys, I need to make this
okay,
fight.
Okay, and then if you go to not guilty, then I would have to come to court and end up testifying to what I saw. Okay, so those are the two things. Okay, did I explain that part?
Yes.
Okay. I'm just going to read your race real quick, okay? You got it on?
Yep.
Okay. The date is 6-11 of 07 at 12:28 hours. Mr. Craig?
Yes.
All right. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in court of law. You have the right to talk to a lawyer now or have a lawyer present now or at any time during questioning. If you cannot afford a lawyer, one will be appointed to you without cost. Do you understand each of these rights if I explain them to you?
I do.
Do you wish to talk to us at this time?
I do.
Okay. I just want to start off with your side of the story, okay? So,
I go into the bathroom here as I normally do. I'm a commuter through here,
okay?
I sit down, go to the bathroom, and you said our feet bumped. I believe they did, because I reached down and scooted over, and the next thing I knew, under the bathroom divider comes a card that says police. Now, that's about as far as I can take it. I don't know of anything else. Your foot came toward mine. Mine came toward yours. Was that natural? I don't know. Did we bump? Yes, I think we did. You said so. I don't disagree with that.
Okay. I don't want to get into a pissing match here.
We're not going to.
That's good.
I am not gay. I don't do these kinds of things.
It doesn't matter. I don't care about sexual preference or anything like that. Here's your stuff back here. I don't care about sexual preference.
I know you don't. You're out to enforce the law.
Right.
But you shouldn't be out to entrap people either.
This is an entrapment.
All right.
You're skipping some parts here, but what about your hand?
What about it? I reached down my foot like this. There was a piece of paper on the floor. I picked it up.
Okay.
What about my hand?
Well, you're not being truthful with me. I'm kind of disappointed in you, Senator. I'm really disappointed right now. Okay. I'm not, just so you know, just like everybody,
yeah.
I treat with dignity. I try to pull him away from the situation, not embarrass him.
I appreciate that.
And
you did that after I stepped out of the stall.
I will say every person I've had so far has told me the truth. We've been respectful to each other, and then they've gone on their way.
Okay.
I've never had to bring anybody to jail because everybody's been truthful to me.
I don't want you to take me to jail, and I think
I'm not going to take you to jail as long as you be cooperative, but I'm not going to lie.
My hand come below the divider? Yes, it did.
Okay, sir. We deal with people that lie to us every day.
I'm sure you do.
And sure you do too, sir.
Gentlemen, so do I.
I'm sure you do. We deal with a lot of people that are very bad people. You're not a bad person.
No, I don't think I am.
So what I'm telling you is I don't want to be lied to.
Okay.
Okay? So let's start over. You're going to get out of here. You're going to have to pay a fine, and that'll be it. Okay?
Fine.
I don't call media. I don't do any of that type of crap.
Fine.
Okay?
Fine.
All right. So let's start from the beginning. You went in the bathroom.
I went in the bathroom.
And then what did you do when you
waited? I stood beside the wall waiting for a stall to open. I got in a stall, sat down. I started to go to the bathroom. Did our feet come together? Apparently they did bump. Well, I don't dispute that.
Okay, when I got out of the stall, I noticed other stalls were open.
They were at the time. At the time I entered, I stood and waited.
Okay.
They were all busy, you know.
Were you looking at me while you were waiting? I could see your eyes. I say you plant your fingers and look up.
Did I glance at your stall? I was glancing at a stall right beside yours, waiting for a fellow to empty it. I saw him stand up, and therefore I thought it was going to empty.
Okay. How long do you think you still have to have this dog?
Oh, a minute or two at the most.
Okay. And when you went in the stall, that long?
Sat down.
Okay. Did you do anything with your feet?
Position them? I don't know at the time. I'm a fairly wide guy.
I understand.
I tend to spread my legs when I lower my pants so they won't slide.
Okay.
Did I slide them too close to yours? Did I look down once your foot was close to mine? Yes. Did we bump? You said so. I don't recall that, but apparently we were close.
Yeah. Well, your foot did touch mine on my side of the stall.
All right.
Okay. And then with the hand, how many times did you put your hand into the stall?
I don't recall. I remember reaching down once. There was a piece of toilet paper back behind me and picking it up.
Okay. Was your palm down or up when you were doing that?
I don't recall.
Okay. I recall your palm being up. Okay.
All right.
When you pick a piece of paper up, your palm would be down when you pick something up.
Yeah, probably would be. I recall picking the paper up.
And I know it's hard to describe here on tape, but actually what I saw was your fingers come underneath the stall, so you're actually touching the bottom of the stall.
I don't believe I did that. I don't do those things.
I saw your left hand, and I could see the gold wedding ring when I went across. I could see that on your left hand.
Wait a moment. My left hand was over here.
I saw
right hand was next to you.
I could tell it was your left hand because your thumb was positioned in a faceward motion. Your thumb was on this side, not on this side.
Well, we can dispute that. I'm not going to fight you in court. I reached down with my right hand to pick up the paper.
What I'm telling you is I could see that, so I know it was your left hand. Also, I could see a gold ring on this finger. So it's obvious it was a left hand.
Well, okay. My left hand was in the direct opposite of the stall from you.
Okay. You travel through here frequently, correct?
I do. Almost weekly.
Have you been successful in any bathrooms here before?
I go to that bathroom regularly in the morning.
I mean for any type of other
activity? No, absolutely not. I don't seek activity in bathrooms.
It's embarrassing.
Well, it's embarrassing for both. I'm not going to fight you.
I know you're not going to fight me, but that's not the point. I would respect you, and I still respect you. I don't disrespect you, but I'm disrespected right now, and I'm not trying to act like I have all kinds of power or anything, but you're sitting here lying to a police officer. It's not a testament that I'm getting from somebody else. I'm experienced to this. I have trained in this, and I know what I'm doing. And I saw you put your hand under there, and you're going to sit there.
I put my hand down.
You put your hand and rubbed it on the bottom of the stall. With your left hand.
Now, wait a moment.
And I'm not dumb. You can say I don't recall
it. If I had turned sideways, that was the only way I could get my left hand over there.
Not that hard for me to reach over my hand to that. It's not that hard. I see it happen every day out here now.
Okay. You do.
I guess I'm going to say I'm just disappointed in you, sir. I just really am. I expect this from the guy that we get out of the hood, but I mean, people vote for you.
Yes, they do on a regular basis.
Unbelievable.
And I'm a respectable person, and I don't do these kinds of...
And I do respect right now, though.
But I didn't use my left hand.
I rolled down
with my right hand like this to pick up a piece of paper.
Was your gold ring on your right hand at any time today?
Of course not. Try to get it off. Look at it.
Okay, then it was your left hand. I saw it with my own eyes.
All right, you saw something that didn't happen.
Embarrassing. Embarrassing. I wonder why we're going down the streets. Do you have anything to add?
No.
Alright. It's embarrassing. Date is 6/11 of 07 at 12:36. Interview's done.
Okay.
Statement by Idaho Republican Senator Larry Craig on pleading guilty to a misdemeanor charge of disorderly conduct after an incident in June. This is live on C-SPAN.
Thank you all very much for coming out today. I will read a statement. First, please let me apologize to my family, friends, and staff, and fellow Idahoans for the cloud placed over Idaho. I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport. I did nothing wrong, and I regret the decision to plead guilty and the sadness that decision has brought on my wife, my family, friends, staff, and fellow Idahoans, and for that, I apologize. In June, I overreacted and made a poor decision. While I was not involved in any inappropriate conduct at the Minneapolis airport or anywhere else, I chose to plead guilty to a lesser charge in hopes of making it go away. I did not seek any counsel, either from an attorney, staff, friends, or family. That was a mistake, and I deeply regret it. Because of that, I have now retained counsel, and I am asking counsel to review this matter and to advise me on how to proceed. For a moment, I want to put my state of mind into context on June 11th. For 8 months leading up to June 11th, my family and I have been relentlessly and viciously harassed by the Idaho Statesman. If you saw the article today, you know why. Let me be clear. I am not gay. I never have been gay. Still, without a shred of truth or evidence to the contrary, the Statesman has engaged in this witch hunt. In pleading guilty, I overreacted in Minneapolis because of the stress the Idaho Statesman investigation and the rumors it has fueled all around Idaho. Again, that overreaction was a mistake, and I apologize for my judgment. Furthermore, I should not have kept this arrest to myself, and I should have told my family and my friends about it. I wasn't eager to share this failure, but I should have anyway, because I am not gay. I love my wife, my family. I care about friends and staff and Idaho. I love serving this great state. Over the years, I have accomplished a lot for Idaho, and I hope Idahoans will allow me to continue to do that. There are still goals I would like to accomplish, and I believe I can still be an effective leader for our state. Next month, I will announce, as planned, as many of you have already been told, whether or not I will seek re-election. As an elected official, I fully realize that my life is open for public criticism and scrutiny, and I take full responsibility for a lapse in judgment I made in attempting to handle this matter myself. It is clear, though, through my action, I have brought a cloud over Idaho, and for that, I seek and ask the people of Idaho to forgive me. As I mentioned earlier, I have retained counsel to examine the matter, and from that, I will make no further comment. This statement will go up on my website today at craig.senate.gov. Any additional comments will be on the website. I'm sure this is an issue that is not yet over, and I will respond accordingly to all of you in the press, as I have always appreciated your willingness to accommodate me. I hope you appreciate my openness to all of you.
Senator,
thank you very much.
Senator, what happened in Minneapolis?
Hey, what if you were gay? Come out of the closet.
To Idahoans, I represent, to my staff, my Senate colleagues, but most importantly, to my wife and my family, I apologize for what I have caused. I am deeply sorry. I have little control over what people choose to believe, but clearly my name is important to me, and my family is so very important also. Having said that, to pursue my legal options as I continue to serve Idaho would be an unwanted, an unfair distraction of my job and for my Senate colleagues. These are serious times of war and of conflict, times that deserve the Senate's and the full nation's attention. There are many challenges facing Idaho that I am currently involved in, and the people of Idaho deserve a senator who can devote 100% of his time and effort to the critical issues of our state and of our nation. Therefore, it is with sadness and deep regret that I announce that it is my intent to resign from the Senate effective September 30th. In doing so, I hope to allow a smooth and orderly transition of my loyal staff and for the person appointed to take my place at William E. Borah's desk. I have full confidence that Governor Otter will appoint a successor who will serve Idaho with distinction.
We have just, Laura and I have just been given a tour by the Whites in their new home. And they're going to be moving into this home this weekend.
This weekend.
There's nothing more hopeful than to be with somebody who said, welcome to my home. Particularly given the fact that these mixed-use housing projects have replaced old-style low-income housing projects that frankly didn't work. There was, the storm came, created a lot of heartbreak and heartache, but people took a different look at how best to help people in their homes. And we're in this beautiful project. It's a stunning project. So I'm with homeowners to be, renters. Here's a homeowner to be right here, right across the street.
That's right.
People are going to be able to say, this is my home. This is really a remarkable project. For the people in New Orleans who remember what this site was like compared to what it is today, they've got to be full of hope. And so I appreciate the builders. I appreciate Alfonso Jackson and Housing and Urban Development group that have helped get this project started. But most of all, I appreciate the homeowners to be. People who are working hard to be able to say, this is my home. And we really appreciate you giving us a chance to come by.
Thank
we
you.
Wish you all the very best.
Thank you.
Your new home. Congratulations. Thank you all. Good job.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
If you're poor, you're powerless, not only in America, but everywhere on earth. If you don't have enough money to protect yourself from danger, danger is going to find you. The aftermath of Hurricane Katrina should be taught in every American school. If you don't get educated, if you don't develop a skill and force yourself to work hard, you'll most likely be poor. And sooner or later, you'll be standing on a symbolic rooftop waiting for help. Chances are that help will not be quick in coming.
Well, our producer Alex Blumberg decided to run this by somebody who is actually in an American high school, 18-year-old Ashley Nelson, who is our next act, and who lives in the Lafitte housing projects in New Orleans, in one of the neighborhoods that got flooded.
That's what he said?
Yeah.
He said that.
On TV, yeah.
To you, what's the thing that stands out most about that?
Basically, he's saying if you're rich, you live, you're poor, you die. And bro, I had no idea that it was a crime to be poor, and the punishment was death.
What was the first that you heard about the hurricane, and what preparations did you make?
When I heard about the hurricane, it was Saturday, and you know it was supposed to come next Sunday night. So when I heard about it, I went over to my grandmother's house, and my whole family was over there, and I'm like, y'all come on. I'm just so amped up. I'm like, y'all, come on, let's go run a call. We got to evacuate. They have a hurricane coming. Then everybody looked at me stupid. They're like, all right, you're going to go run a call because we have that kind of money to go in, out of town, and we got that kind of money to do that kind of stuff, like being sarcastic about it. And I'm like, man, I forgot we poor. I promise you, that's what I thought in my head. Like, I forgot we were poor.
Were there people who were able to get out, who had a car, or could...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I remember that day I was sitting outside, and a lot of people just running from their house to their car, from their house to their car, just throwing stuff in there, trying to hurry up and get out before the traffic get too hectic. That was a handful of people, and everybody else was just sitting there watching how people leaving, and they got to stay. Because I know that's what I was thinking when I seen people leaving. I'm like, they leaving, and I got to stay. And it's not even optional. I have to stay.
Ashley wrote out the storm at her father's house in Jefferson Parish, across the river from New Orleans, where the rest of her family was. There wasn't too much flooding there, so the next morning, they went out and found all the scrap wood they could, blown down branches, old fences, and started a fire to cook the little bit of meat they'd been able to buy at the store before the storm came. They figured that would hold them until rescuers got there. But one day passed, and no one came, and then 2 days. They had no TV. They didn't know what was going on.
I thought, like, just like my daddy, somebody was coming to help us. Nobody came help us. No Red Cross trucks, no nothing. I mean, at least they could have dropped us some water. You know what it's like to not have water? You get a taste in your mouth that's just, oh, it's horrible. Your mouth all dry and you can't even think right. you start getting delusional and hallucinating about things.
Did you actually have hallucinations?
Yeah.
What did you hallucinate?
Water bottles. Four water bottles. Big Kentwood gallon jugs. I'm serious. I went crazy. I mean, I would just sit down and rock and think about just is the world going to turn to hell and we all going to burn? I just started going crazy. I'm really crazy.
Did it make you realize, like, oh, so this is what it feels like. This is what it feels like to be starving.
I thought that when I was in Jefferson Barracks, I thought that I was like, man, I'm starving. That's what I said to myself. I'm like, man, I'm starving. Like, you know how your stomach growls?
Uh-huh.
Like, when you're starving, you get cramps in your stomach. And it feel like your stomach just bending into your back. And you just, I mean, the best bet is for you to lean forward.
How scared were you?
I thought I was going to die. I mean, I look at it like this now. 9/11 was bad because it was terrorists. You know, there's no surprise people hate the United States. It's no big surprise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but New Orleans was worse because it was our own government who betrayed us. They betrayed us. They betrayed us. Like, they left us there to die. And then you hear George Bush telling the FEMA man, you're doing a good job. What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? Because, I mean, people are dying there. So you telling him he's doing a good job, what you saying, like, that's good, the people dying? I never understood that, and I really wish I could meet him to ask him, what do you mean by that, he's doing a good job?
Thanks. Now to a video clip that's become the talk of the internet. It's taken from Friday's Miss Teen USA pageant, and it shows a very nervous Miss South Carolina having a very tough time in the question and answer part of the program. Take a look.
Recent polls have shown a fifth of Americans can't locate the U.S. on a world map. Why do you think this is?
I personally believe that U.S. Americans are unable to do so because some people out there in our nation don't have maps, and I believe that our education, like such as in South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and I believe that they should, our education over here in the U.S. should help the U.S. or should help South Africa and should help the Iraq and the Asian countries, so we will be able to build up our future.
Miss South Carolina, Caitlin Upton, good morning.
Good morning.
You get so nervous about this, but let me tell you something. You have no idea what this man says on a regular basis on this live program. That's nothing.
Can we also, yeah. That's the first time you've seen that, isn't it?
Yes, actually, that is the first time I have seen that, and I'm nervous just sitting here right now left. National television again.
I know. And it was the first time actually you had been on national television.
Yes,
and here you were competing.
Time.
And it was just one of those moments when you were asked this question. I'm sure everything came at you at once.
Yes, everything did come at me at once. I was overwhelmed and I made a mistake. Everybody makes a mistake. I'm human.
At what point, Caitlin, during the answer, did you start to think to yourself, is this making any sense?
Right when that question was asked to me, I was in complete shock and I was just overwhelmed that I seriously think I only heard about one or two words of the actual question itself. And
you just kind of drew a blank?
Yes, I drew a blank. I misunderstood. I made a mistake.
You know, as we've said, you know, we do live television every day. Caitlin, if I can't even count the number of times I've said things, and then we've all gone to commercial break, and we've looked at each other like, what did you just say? I mean, so please, you know, don't let it get you down. I mean, and I know the fact that it's on YouTube and a lot of people are watching it right now probably has to be a double-edged sword. On the one hand, you think it's kind of funny. On the other hand, it's not all that funny to you, is it?
No, but then again, looking back on it, I am sitting here laughing at myself because I feel like, is that really me standing up there answering that
it's
question?
It's an out-of-body experience.
Yeah, it's like I'm not in my actual body.
I give you a lot of credit for being here. You know, you could just go under the covers, but here you are sitting here to laugh at yourself. So you know what I say? Good girl. Good girl, you.
Yes, definitely.
You still finished, what, in the top four?
Yes, I actually placed third runner-up.
And so, and have you allowed yourself to go back and think, what if I had done a little better on that question, how the outcome might have been different?
For example, do you want to redo on that question?
I would love to re-answer that question.
Okay, so let me ask you that question again. The question is, recent polls have shown that a fifth of Americans can't locate the U.S. on a world map. Why do you think this is, Caitlin?
Well, personally, my friends and I, we know exactly where the United States is on our map. I don't know anyone else who doesn't, and if the statistics are correct, I believe that there should be more emphasis on geography in our education so people will learn how to read maps better.
Yay! I've got to tell you, that was the perfect answer.
You know, I think they should just do the thing over on Friday. Come on, let's go back to Friday night. Let's
yeah,
give her another
shot at it.
Let's
go back in time and redo everything.
Hey, girl, you're just 18 years old.
Yes, I am 18, and I believe that I'm a very strong person. I have a strong character, and my parents raised me very well.
What are your plans? What do you want to do? I mean, you know, in terms of after that pageant, what are your goals?
Well, my goal is to attend Appalachian State University, major in graphic design. Once graduated from there, go to LA and go into the International Academy of Design and Technology, major in special effects, learning to design special effects for movies and television.
Mm. Good for you. You go.
Well, you've got a lot of grit.
Thank
Caitlin,
you.
Caitlin, good luck to you and
thank
everything.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for being big enough to laugh at yourself this morning. It's hard.
Thank you.
I know.
I was terrified, but at the same time, determined to get that picture. And it's really hard to describe the state that you go into in a moment like that. It's cliche to talk about out-of-body experiences, but it really did feel like I was watching somebody else do it. And when you have a camera in front of your eye and you're focusing so intently to get a sharp, good image, you tend to shut out anything that's peripheral. And at that moment, even though there was the noise of the crowd and the helicopters and various other things going on in the city, everything went completely silent. And I felt almost what I can only describe as immediate contact with that dead soldier, and almost a conversation. What was the conversation? Well, I heard a voice very distinctly. I've sought psychiatric help in subsequent years, and my psychiatrist said it was my superego. I believe it was William David Cleveland's voice. And he said, as clearly as something inside your head and outside at the same time, if you do this, I will own you forever. And then I tried, without opening my mouth, I tried to say, forgive me, but understand why I have to do this. And any of the soldiers who knew how fast this mission was going wrong would understand only from those words what I meant. What did that voice mean to you? How did it interpret it? How did you interpret it when you heard his voice saying, if you do this, I will own you forever? I took it as a warning, and I actually, the response that I thought was just understand that I have to do this. I don't have a choice. I don't want to do this. I don't want to participate in your desecration, because that's what I did. I mean, if someone hadn't photographed what those Somalis were doing, obviously it would have been real, it would have happened, but it would have been kept on the streets of Mogadishu. By photographing it, it became a global image. It became a repetitive abuse of a man's body. And, I've done a lot of reading after this to try and understand if this is a religious thing or if there's some taboo that we learn about not desecrating bodies. But I'm convinced that there's something deeply innate in the human psyche, no matter religion, creed, culture, that says this is wrong. We all know not to do that. And yet, I had to photograph what they were doing in order to tell the truth, because the truth was being denied by the Pentagon. What did the photograph actually show? Describe it. Staff Sergeant Cleveland had been stripped of his clothes. He was wearing green army issue underwear and was naked, but for that. His arms were bound at the wrist, and there was at least one rope around one of his ankles. He had numerous bullet wounds, and I remember very distinctly noticing as they flipped him back and forth that he was limp. And I thought to myself, could he possibly still be alive, because rigor mortis hasn't set in? And I these thoughts are going through one's head, obviously, rapid fire. But I was, I was seeing those minute details while at the same time trying to get enough photographs. And in this instance, we're talking about, I think, 3 or 4 frames before my guards pulled me away and back into the car for my own safety. Okay, so you had just like a few seconds really to take these shots. That's right. Were you thinking like, how am I going to frame this? What is the emphasis going to be on? The body, the mob, a little bit of both? Or did you just like snap it without even thinking what you were framing? No, I was actually thinking, because and this is an interesting part of the story. The first shots I took are full body pictures, and there's an old man to one side who has his cane in full swing clubbing the Cleveland's corpse with his cane, and then people are dancing around him. My bodyguards pulled me away because they heard people saying things in the crowd which they took as death threats. And at that in those frames, it's rather happy, jubilant faces. When they pulled me back into the car, I was sitting right next to the right passenger door with two bodyguards next to me in the back seat. I immediately thought that and pardon me for being somewhat graphic, the image showed the underwear slightly askew. So part of the corpse's genitals were exposed, a very small part. But I knew from having worked with photographers on other stories that that's the kind of thing a newspaper wouldn't print. The violence was perhaps going to be acceptable, but the exposure of sex organs wouldn't be. So the driver was waiting for the crowd to move off, and it moved off around a corner to the left. I immediately popped open the door and jumped back out, ran around the front of the car, and then the crowd stopped, and then I took a half-body photograph, which is the one that most people would recognize.
Once you took the photos, you had to get them out of the country back to, who did you have to send them back to?
My first stop was back to the hotel, where I basically collapsed, both hating myself for what I had done and also wondering who the hell I thought I was. I literally collapsed in, sobbing on a bed in my hotel room. After stuffing, I took the film out and stuffed it under the mattress. I was sort of berating myself for having taken a risk that was extreme, because at that moment, the significance of what I'd done really hadn't sunk in. I didn't know whether anyone would print the pictures, and I had a pretty strong feeling that they wouldn't.
But they did. The Associated Press printed it, and so did Time Magazine. But they each did
it
differently. Why don't you describe the difference?
AP moved the half-body shots, which appeared in newspapers across America, because there was long debate by many newspaper editors about whether these were acceptable or not. But most, and I've spoken to some of them in subsequent years, decided that they had no choice, that it just was too significant not to print. What Time Magazine did, which is intriguing to me, is they digitally altered the underwear so that when you look at the full-page photograph in Time Magazine, you don't see any genitals exposed. But you do see horrific desecration of an American corpse.
You quote Brendan Behan. Each of your chapters has a terrific quote to kick it off. And one of the chapters starts with this quote from Brendan Behan: "A bit of shooting takes your mind off your troubles. It makes you forget the cost of living."
Hmm.
So getting back to suffering with chronic depression before becoming a war correspondent, do you think that that's part of it? That that war takes your mind off your own inner war?
Yeah, and there's probably an even better one in my situation. I'm quoted in there, to the effect of men start wars because it helps make sure that women don't laugh at them.
how do you interpret that?
Well, in my case, it made me feel bigger than I really am.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it doesn't take a lot to put your life on the line and take pictures or write stories. All you have to be willing to do is to die. The rewards are huge. People think you're courageous and heroic and all those things, which you really aren't. You're more sick than anything, in my opinion. So the payback is big. And each time you get away with it, you think, wow, I'm pretty cool. I'm better than everybody else because I can get away with this. When in fact, you're simply lucky. Lucky that you're not dead, and unlucky that you're suffering a mental illness.
Are you saying being a war correspondent is a form of mental illness?
I think it is. I've spent enough time around people who do this a lot. In my opinion, and I include myself foremost in this group, it's a lot of misfits, People who are seeking self-esteem through risk, we all, you know, the standard question is, why do you do this? And the standard answer usually is, in pursuit of the truth. Well, anyone who's done this for any length of time doesn't have to think very hard to see that the truth is really not getting out. The amount of obfuscation and deception that's carried out by militaries, governments, that we're trying to cut through is so enormous that the work a war correspondent does, you know, it may shine a little light, but I really don't think that we're knights on white horses, that's for sure.
Thank you. Betsy, tell me your full name, please.
Betsy Allison Walter.
Betsy Allison Walter, and you're 8 years old?
Almost 9.
And you live in Manhattan?
Mm-hmm.
And you're in our studio in New York. I appreciate you taking some time to come in and telling us this story. You wrote a letter to the mayor of New York, Mayor Koch.
Right.
Tell me about that, please.
Well, I wrote to him because my parents are getting divorced, and I really don't know who to turn to. And I just told him that my parents are getting divorced, and my dad is with somebody else, and I was just getting used to something, and now this, and it's really kind of hard on me, and I like an opinion.
Why did you write to Mayor Koch?
Because he's somebody who I thought he's very good to us, I guess, because he's the mayor and he knows a lot of things, and I thought he would know about this, too.
Yeah. Did you get an answer back?
Yes.
What did he say?
It's very short. Thank you for the letter. I was saddened to learn of the difficult times you are experiencing now. It is important for you to share your feelings and thoughts with someone during this time. I wish there was an easy solution to these problems, but there is not. Please remember that you are loved and that people care about you. All the best. Sincerely, Edward Koch.
That's nice. Was that reassuring to you in a way?
No.
No? Did you have any thought in your mind that perhaps he could actually do something about it? For example, call your father and get your mom and dad back together?
No.
No, you just wanted some advice.
But see, I tried it sometimes, like, because I had a dance recital one day, and I invited them both, but I wanted them to sit next to each other, but they didn't.
Yeah. What other advice have you been able to come across, to find?
Well, the guidance counselor, she said that a lot of kids have the same problem. Say there are 400 in school, say, and like 300 of them have the same problem.
Sure, sure. You know, most people you talk with will have had parents who were divorced.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, most people. It's kind of a sad thing, but most people get through it all right, too. That's my advice for you.
Thank you.
You wrote another letter to somebody who had written a book called The Boys and Girls Book of Divorce?
Yes.
A psychologist?
Mm-hmm.
And what did that person tell you?
Well, he said that I should try another of his books to find out help.
Oh, he wanted you to go out and buy his book, did you?
Well, we had the one he recommended.
And how did that go? What did you think of that one?
Well, the problem is, he puts things in a way that I can't really quite get it through me, that I already know, and I want some real advice that my questions really are, not just answers that people keep telling me over and over again.
Can you give me an example, Betsy?
Why'd they get divorced? What happened?
Do you think that parents sometimes don't think children are old enough to understand or can't handle it and so will hide some information?
Yes.
Not that they have to say everything, but you think there ought to be a little bit more sharing of the information.
Yeah, that's what my mom said.
Yeah. And in terms of their own divorce, do you understand it better now?
No.
No? Why? What still don't you understand about that?
Well, why did they have to go off and do it? Because, see, the most painful part is when I saw my dad packing up, and I really don't understand because, like, it's hard because they won't tell me what happened to them, and I really want them back together, and I don't understand why they can't.
Yeah. What do you think you've learned from this? Do you think if somebody else in school, for example, told you that their parents were getting divorced, how do you think you could advise them?
Well, I wrote a book, and I think I would say the same information that I said.
You wrote a very small book?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have it there?
Mm-hmm.
Could you read some of it for me, please?
All right. Let me get it. It's called A Book About Divorce. Should I read the whole book? It's short.
Sure.
It's not your fault when your parents get divorced. Why does it have to be you? Because mommy and daddy don't love each other anymore. Remember, it's okay to be sad and cry. Tell someone about your feelings. That's it.
That's nice. Listen, Betsy, thank you for talking with us. I appreciate it, and I wish you the best. I hope things go well for you.
Thank you.
And maybe this is the beginning of a writing experience for you, and you can grow up to be a writer.
I don't want to, but I want to write, like, like one book that would make it, but not a whole series, you know.
You just want to write a book and make a lot of money.
No, not money, just famous.
Okay. Okay. Okay, Betsy, thank you. Good night.
Okay, good night.
So that's the tape from 20 years ago. You're in the studio with us now. Tell us your name.
Betsy Allison Walter.
How old are you?
I just turned 29.
And you're working?
I am. I have been an elementary school teacher for the past 7 years.
And looking back at that moment, did you really want the truth? Or did you want things to be well again and whole again? And
I don't believe that I wanted what the truth really was, but I wanted what I had created the truth to be in my head. I wanted them to say something to the fact that, you know, oh, we just need a time apart, and of course we'll come back together. I wanted what I thought the truth was. If I had heard the real truth, I think that it would have been devastating.
Your dad was fooling around?
Mm-hmm. And my mom did an amazing job of never, ever putting any blame on him, of always being supportive of us having a relationship. But if she had said the truth, I couldn't have a relationship with him. I would have been too angry.
Okay, let's imagine this. Your advice just to that 8-year-old Betsy, who was you?
I do grapple with this. It's hard because I know exactly what I wanted to hear when I was 8. I think I would tell her that, you know what, I would actually say, this is probably how your life is going to be. You know, your parents are made this choice for you. And now, instead of questioning and wondering for so long why this choice was made, how are you going to live your life now knowing this is your life? I think I still know myself, and I would have been persistent wanting answers regardless, but I do think that I needed to feel less helpless.
Show notes at lies.com. I'm John Callender. Thanks for listening. Too much too.
all the animals I hear a mad dog bark, she'll tell you what it said to